I'm ready to go. I think it's running. Just make sure.
Wait. No.
Okay. Well, this is cozy. I was hoping it wasn't going to be in the church because it's nicer to just be closer together. Sarah, I'm going to give you some money. You can go out for a coffee.
Yeah.
Please.
I'm ready.
No, this is like interestingly awkward having someone who's part of my story here, but I think God, I think the Lord is in this and he's going to use it, so just quiet. Okay.
Good luck.
Yeah. Anyway, it's great to be here and great to have the opportunity. I made a deal with the Lord a long time ago. Jews make deals with God. It's kind of a biblical thing, but when the Lord worked very dramatically in my life, I felt like he kind of said to me, whenever you're asked to share your story, I want you to do it. And I want you to make an effort to really say yes to that whenever, because it's a gift, something I've given you, and I want you to share that gift. So I'm really glad to be here, but it's, you know, it's always really in obedience to that promise to really share how God has worked in my life. And I want to say something at the beginning. I wasn't planning on saying it, but I think it's important for me to say it because I don't get to be in this situation very much with Sister Sarah. I honestly don't think I would be here today if she hadn't reached out to me and said yes to the Lord and really done maybe the hardest thing, which is to evangelize a Jew. So thank you. Thank you for saying yes and listening to the Lord. And you know, as I unfold my story, you'll see that she wasn't the perfect evangelist, which makes the story even better because it's more God than it is her. But I want to honor you for your yes to the Lord before I even begin. So thank you for that. So, okay, well, let's go back a ways. I grew up in a Jewish home on the North Shore of Chicago, and I grew up with Jewish friends and Jewish family and Jewish schoolmates, and I pretty much thought everyone in the world was Jewish when I was growing up. I'm sure some of you felt that way growing up Catholic. I really didn't know that I knew there were other world religions out there, but I didn't really have contact with people who were really living and believing their faith. And so back in the dark ages, before the World Wide Web, yes, Grace, there was a time back then, it was very conceivable that I was really cut off from knowing more about Christianity in particular, especially living in a home where we were very Jewish, and really I would say the goal of my grandparents and my parents was really to keep us Jewish. And it sounds kind of funny, but there's a very big stress on no intermarriage, and that we're really supposed to maintain our Jewish identity. And that's very hard to do if you're going off and kind of marrying Gentiles and intermarrying and stuff. So that was a message I got very early on, that you're Jewish, you will always be a Jew, and you should do nothing to really jeopardize your Jewish identity. Like I said, I was one of four kids. I have an identical twin sister and an older brother, 2 years older, and a younger brother, 4 years younger. My dad's parents were very well-known in the Jewish community in Chicago. My grandmother was the president of a Jewish organization called Hadassah, which is the biggest charitable organization in the world. And she was president of the Chicago chapter, which I think had probably the second largest number of Jews in the States. So even before I was born, my grandparents were raising money for the State of Israel. They were very good friends when they went to Israel with people like, I don't know if these names will mean anything to you, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, who else? Moshe Dayan. These are like heroes of the State of Israel. And my grandparents knew them all. When Eleanor Roosevelt came to Chicago, she wanted to meet my grandparents because they had played such an important role in the State of Israel. So this is what was drilled into me from the time I was very young, not only that I was a Jew, but that it was significant that my grandparents were Zionists. So I was very, very happy to be a Jew, very proud to be a Jew, but really did not know anything, honestly, about Christianity. I knew Jesus was like the founder of a world religion, that he was someone who lived in history, who was, in my mind, who was a Christian, but I didn't know anything else about him. So, anyway, you know, I don't want to take a whole lot of time to talk about, like, my childhood growing up, but I think it was fairly, like, dysfunctional, like most, a lot of people, without saying a whole lot more about that. But, you know, obviously my parents loved each other very much and, you know, had a very, a lifelong marriage together, which nowadays is not something you take for granted. We grew up very much going to synagogue, and I was, when my sister and I were 13, we were bat mitzvah. How many of you know what a bar mitzvah is or bat mitzvah? Okay, looks like most of you do. So it's very much like confirmation. It's a rite of passage in Judaism where you study for a whole year under the rabbi. They give you a portion of the Torah that you memorize, and you learn how to chant in Hebrew. And then you get up in front of the whole congregation and your family and your friends on this one special day. And you tell everyone why you're ready to be an adult member of the Jewish faith, which is kind of a joke, because most 13-year-olds aren't really ready to be a member of the human race, let alone So it was kind of a joke, but it's a big deal, you know. And so it was a big deal to us to be able to do that. And so in many ways, we were very, very much into our Jewish faith on the weekends. And then during the week, we were very much like normal kids. When I was 15, we had something happen in our family, which I think really began to impact me. I would say from like 12 to 15, I was really in a place of saying, Is God really there? Is God real? Does God even exist? Kind of, I think, the normal questioning. But I didn't have anybody kind of speaking into my life saying, yes, of course he does. And yes, the stories in the Bible are really true. And so for me, it was kind of just something I did, a cultural thing I did, part of my culture. But I don't think I ever experienced God at that point being like in my life and being real and being personal. So when I was 15, my brother Mark was a freshman at a university, and my sister and brother and I, the three of us, the three oldest kids, were invited to go on a vacation with some of our family to the Bahamas. And when my sister and I got to Florida, we were going to meet my brother Mark there a couple hours later because he was finishing up some finals. We were met at the airport in Florida at the gate. Back then you could actually go to the gate, and we were met there by some family friends who said, your brother, we just got a phone call from your parents, and your brother's been in an accident on his way home from school, and we'd like to take you home with us until we have more information about it. So we went to these people's house, and I still remember the day so clearly. We were just waiting, and I remember standing in their yard next to their swimming pool, and I remember praying. And I remember really praying for the first time in my life. And I had said a lot of prayers growing up, you know, a lot of prayers in Hebrew and spent a lot of time in synagogue. But I think it was really genuinely the first time I tried to reach out to God and to really talk to him. And I remember just saying, God, I don't know if you're real and I don't know if you're here, but if you care, save my brother's life. And it probably was just a few minutes after I prayed that prayer that we got a phone call saying that my brother had been driving home on a snowy night on a two-lane highway and had been run off the road by a semi-truck, not wearing a seatbelt, and had died in a small hospital before my parents could even get there. And I remember when I received the news, almost instantly my reaction was, God, where are you? Where are you? How can you let something like this happen? How can you say that you care about us? I was very angry, as you can imagine, and my sister and I flew back the next day to our parents, who were incredibly, you know, overcome with grief. We have a lot of Jewish customs and mourning rites. People come to your house for several days. It's called sitting Shiva, and they bring food, and they pray with you, and talk. And I remember going around the house during these 2 or 3 days and just talking to different people, like, where is God? How could God allow this to happen? And everyone kept pointing me to the next person. Like, I sat down with an aunt, and she pointed me to a teacher, who pointed me to a friend, and then finally I ended up sitting down with the rabbi, who was like 120 years old. And I just like poured myself out. I was so angry, and I was just asked all those questions, just came rushing out of me. You know, why does God allow horrible things to happen to good people? You know, and then finally I said, and what happens when we die? Like, what happens when we die? And he sat there and he looked at me, and he was quiet for what seemed like forever. And then I remember the 3 words he said to me, which was so shocking. He said, I don't know. That I don't know why God allows these things to happen. I don't know what happens when we die. And that just kind of fueled my rage. So it's like, are you serious? You're like, you represent my faith to me, and you don't know why? You can't answer the biggest questions that are out there? And so I remember at that point kind of making this decision that if God wasn't real, or God wasn't there, or God didn't at least didn't care about me in some personal way, I was just going to live my own life, and I was going to live as if he didn't exist. Because if he was a God who cared and he allowed horrible things to happen, then why should I care? I mean, it was a very, it was, you know, a decision fueled by a lot of grief and a lot of teenage angst, but that's kind of where I was. So the rest of my high school years were just really filled with two goals. One goal was to go to a good college and get out of my house and really kind of take ownership of my life and make my life something. The second goal, which was a little bit contrary to the first, was to kind of do everything I could to block out the fact that I was living in a house with so much grief. So it meant partying on the weekends and, you know, just focusing on friends and, you know, without going into a lot of detail, looking for a lot of love in all the wrong places. And just really kind of living as if, you know, nothing mattered except that moment. Is that like background music for you? Like such good timing. How about some 70s rock and roll? That might be a little more appropriate.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
They're imposing the blessings.
Seems appropriate. Yeah. So on the weekends I was doing all that stuff, and during the week I just was so focused on studying, getting good grades. So I began to apply for colleges, and I got in my mind that I wanted to go to the University of Michigan. I had no clue why I wanted to go there, except I think they had a good football team back then. But I didn't know anybody. I was pretty shy, actually. A lot of people don't know that about me because I you know, speak a lot, but I am actually, by nature, rather shy. And so here I am thinking I'm going to go off to this huge university by myself, but I was determined to go. So I remember we got our letters in the mail, my sister and I, we both applied to Michigan, and I remember I got mine on like a Wednesday, and it was the acceptance letter, and she got hers on a Thursday, and it was the rejection letter. Maybe rejection is like kind of a strong word, but you know what I mean. But anyway, here we were. I remember my mom put us in a room and said, all right, girls, split up everything you own. And it was very symbolic, down to like the last pair of socks. We had shared everything our whole life, you know, clothing and friends and boyfriends and, well, maybe not boyfriends. you know, everything, socks and underwear. And we sat there in the room until everything we own was divided to the last thing, and it was like very symbolic. It was like we were both getting ready to go off our own ways, and so I went off to Michigan, she went to Indiana, and my parents drove me up to Michigan. This is how desperate I was, you guys. I didn't even visit the school. I mean, can you imagine, like, going someplace and not even visiting there? And I remember, I'll just tell you this because you're Ann Arbor, so you'll appreciate it. I remember we drove in the back way off State Street, and it was like a dump. Like, I mean, it's a lot nicer now than it is, but coming up, like, old State Street, like, past, like, Yost, and I'm like, I'm going to school here? Oh, my gosh. This place is like a dump. But anyway, I got put in Bursley Hall, which was clearly away from where I wanted to be, and I was like, okay, I'm going to, like, really make a go of this, and I'm sure there's tons of Jewish kids on campus. It's, you know, I was bummed I didn't get put in Mojo, which was called Little Israel, which is where all the Jewish kids were. But I'm like, okay, I'm going to meet other kids. So I go up on my floor. I wouldn't even let my parents come up to my room. They, like, left me in the lobby there, and I was like, and I was kind of crying because I was, like, so relieved to see them go and also, like, scared to death. Like, okay, you wanted this. Now, here we go. So I was rooming blind with a girl named Lori Brown who I'd never met. She was from, I don't know, where she's, like, south of, yeah, Flat Rock or something like that, or Rockwood or something. I thought, well, Lori Brown, she's clearly not Jewish. But I walked up and down the hall even before I moved my stuff into the room, and it was a freshman hall, and so they had all the girls' names on the doors, and I was like, there is nobody Jewish on this floor. And you ask, well, how did I know? Well, you know. Like, you know. So just by the names. So I go in, and I'm like, okay, I need to meet Lori. And back in the day, that was before they, like, really strategically put you with someone who was similar to you. It really was a crapshoot who you got. And so Lori had been there for the whole day. Her whole side of this tiny room was already set up. And I remember thinking, I'm going to be really outgoing. And so I went up to her, and on her dresser was this picture. And I remember looking at the picture and pointing to this guy and saying, well, that guy's pretty cute. Is he your boyfriend? Yeah. So Lori looks at me, and she's probably thinking, you got into school here? Like, she's like, you don't know who that is, or something like that. And I'm like, no. And then she said something really strange. She said, his name is Jesus, and he is my boyfriend. So, you're weird. Yeah. The Beach Boy Jesus over here. I think at that point I was like, have you ever had a bagel? I mean, we were like kind of sparring. She clearly hadn't, but... here's what I find out about Lori Brown, my first roommate, my first experience of Michigan, my first Christian. Lori was a Catholic who the summer of her senior year of high school had really encountered the Lord. She had been invited to a course called the Life in the Spirit Seminar, had really met the Lord, and had come to Michigan really wanting to live her Catholic faith and really live for the Lord. But Lori also knew we need to coexist in this tiny room, and so she really tried to live her faith, but she wasn't really kind of in my face about it. But it was clear to me that she, just by her, you know, the artwork in her room, that she believed something different than I did. So I began to meet other girls on my floor, and there was a girl on my floor who I thought was really crazy in kind of a fun way, and her name was Sarah. I'm pretty sure she had Converse high tops at the time. So she also played guitar, and she walked up and down the halls at different points, like just asking people if they wanted to hear songs. And do you remember that? Yeah. Anyway, Sarah and I became friends, and we had almost nothing in common except one thing. We both were athletes, and we both liked to play sports, and so we found ourselves going to North Campus Rec Center together and signing up for playing on teams together, basketball and playing racquetball and doing other things. And I don't know how much in Sarah's mind, how intentional she was, probably somewhat, but we began to just have a friendship, and we began to kind of have these pretty epically failed debates from the Old Testament and the New Testament, because I know I didn't really know that much about what I had learned, and she was a Catholic, so I don't know how much she knew at that time about the scriptures.
So I know more now.
So what I want to say is, what was happening here was, is, you know, obviously in retrospect, was probably what you'd call relational evangelization. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't any kind of plan where she sat down and kind of explained things to me theologically, but there was definitely, which was probably good because I would have pushed it away. But we became friends, and then I discovered there were other girls in our hall who were also Christians. About a month or two into the semester, I was taking a great books class, and the professor asked us to read something from the book of Romans and to write an essay on it. And I remember afterwards I went up to him and I said, that book was not on the book list. I don't have the book of Romans. And he said, it's in the New Testament. And I said, I'm not allowed to have a New Testament, you know. My grandfather won't contribute to my tuition if I have a New Testament. And he basically said, I don't care. Like, find the book, do the assignment, read it. So I remember going down and asking Sarah if I could borrow her Bible to do the assignment. And she was more than happy to lend it to me. And I think kind of put the little red bookmark in there and said, here's the book of Romans. It's really hard. If you need help, I could probably help you with it. And I was like, no, that's fine. So I took her Bible back. This is it, actually. This is the real deal. Yes. Pretty old. And I opened it up to where she had put the bookmark, and I started to read Romans, and I was totally lost because I had no context for understanding. I didn't know who Jesus was. I didn't know who Paul was. I didn't know really anything about it, and so I gave up pretty quickly. But I started to flip through this Bible. First of all, I had never met anyone who owned their own Bible. Her name is actually on the front, engraved. Jews had, like a lot of Catholics, have like maybe have one Bible in their house, and it's gathering dust someplace. But I never met anyone who owned their own Bible, and I was just really enthralled by a couple of things. One was that she had my Bible in her Bible. In other words, I didn't know that the Christian Bible contained the Old Testament. The second thing was, as I began to flip through this Bible, it became really clear to me that she actually read this thing. Can you guys see this? You liked Ephesians. You underlined almost all of it. And then she wrote in the margins, and then she ran out of room, so she wrote on the maps in the back. And I was just like, I felt like I was holding someone's personal diary. And I felt like in some strange way, the words on these pages were speaking to her. And she was speaking back. There was a conversation, a dialogue that was happening here. And honestly, it kind of freaked me out. And I remember later, much, much later, when I was reading in the book of Hebrews, and I came across this passage which so articulated what I experienced when I looked through Sarah's Bible. And that was, the Word of God is living and active. It's sharper than any two-edged sword. And I felt like if I held on to this book for too long, it might start to speak to me. And then I might get weird and speak back to it. So, but I share that as it was a window. It was a way for me to be able to see that someone out there thought that God was real. So I remember giving the Bible back to Sarah and thanking her for it. And I don't even know if I did the assignment or what I got on it. But so, all right, I'm going to look at my watch here. What's my time frame? Oh, okay. So, anyway, a few months later, it was probably the beginning of March, and I'm going to kind of just highlight some of the more important workings of God here. There's a lot in between that I'm not going to say, but it was March, and it was Lent. I didn't know it was Lent, but I think Sarah and maybe a couple other girls came knocking at my door and said, hey, we're going to take a study break in the lounge. Do you want to come and watch this movie? That was back before everyone had their own flat screen TV in their dorm room, and you actually had to, like, come together to watch a movie. So we sit down in the room. It was probably about half the size of this room, and there's a TV on, and Sarah and I are sitting next to each other on the floor. Do you remember this? And the movie starts, and I'm thinking, what is this movie? Like, what is this movie? And so I think I leaned over and I whispered to Sarah, like, what's the name of this movie? And she's like, oh, it's nothing. And yeah, I was like, what is, and then the, you know, it comes on and it's like, Jesus of Nazareth. Have any of you ever seen that one?
Yeah.
It's the one where Jesus never blinks for the whole movie. Just the whole time. Yeah, seriously. You need to go back and watch it. But anyway, immediately I thought, I need to get out of here. Like, I'm, you know, like, it's another, like, red flag. And I'm not supposed to be watching this kind of thing. But honestly, sitting there in a room on a floor with a bunch of people, I was so shy and a little bit, you know, didn't want to kind of make a fuss that I was afraid to get up and move. So I watched this as the story of Jesus' life begins to unfold. And I remember at a certain point, pretty early on, I turned to Sarah and I whispered to her, he's Jewish. Sounds so obvious, but it's like the best kept secret amongst Jews. Honestly, I was like, I didn't know Jesus was a Jew. And as I watched this Hollywood version of Jesus' life unfold, I thought to myself, not only is he Jewish, but it seems like he was a really good Jew. Like, you know, he went to synagogue and he went to the temple and he observed the feasts and he kept the law and he listened to his brother, his mother. And so I was pretty stunned. And my whole life, I think I had grown up thinking Jesus was one of them, and all of a sudden he's one of us. And that just kind of blew my categories. So I would say I was very kind of, taken in by this person of Jesus that I saw. Not only because he was Jewish, but I think I saw something characterized in him about the way he was that I wanted to be, and I knew I couldn't be. The way he loved people, the way he wasn't afraid to speak the truth, the way he, you know, stood by his convictions. Anyway, I remember the movie was being shown in two parts, and so the first part was almost ending, and the scene unfolds in the movie where Jesus goes to a town, and when he reaches the edge of this town, a town called Bethany, he's met there by a woman who begins to weep. And she says to him, Lord, where were you? If you'd been here, our brother would not have died. It's the story of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. I remember sitting there thinking, are you serious? This is like a script out of my own life. Like, and then at that point, everything in me wanted to just get up and just like run. I was like, I don't want to deal with another scene where, you know, there are no answers and where... So I honestly felt like in me I wanted to get up, but as I sat there I almost felt like somebody was like putting their hand on my shoulder and just pressing me to the floor. And I watched as Jesus goes to this tomb where Lazarus has been there for 4 days. And I knew as a Jew that that was a place that Jesus shouldn't have been, that it was ritually unclean. You don't go and visit the dead and hang out with the dead. But I watched as Jesus goes there and he raises Lazarus from the dead. And I remember having this thought as I watched the scene, like, who is this guy? Like, is he the one? And when Jews say, is he the one, that means, is he the Messiah? Is he the one that has power over death? And I remember that night going back to my room and being really kind of disturbed and I couldn't sleep. And I remember, I don't know if you remember this, going down to your room that night and just knocking on Sarah's door. It was pretty late. And I don't even know if we said anything to each other very much, but I remember you gave me your Bible. And I remember taking it back to my dorm room, sitting in my beanbag chair. And finding that ribbon, which happened to be, I think, in the Gospel of Matthew, and sitting there and reading Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And I remember I came to the part in John where Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die, but the one who believes in me will live forever. And that was the scene I had just watched. And I didn't know what most of those words meant, but I knew that there was like a promise implicit in those words. And I knew that I needed to find out what the truth was. And so I prayed for the second time in my life. That night, I said, God, I don't know if you're real. I don't know who Jesus is. But if he's the Messiah, show me and give me the faith to believe. And I prayed that prayer with so much, you know, very earnestly, and nothing happened. Nothing. No one delivered a free pizza. no signs, you know. But I brought the Bible back to Sarah, and I think pretty much she said, why don't you hang on to it for a while, and why don't you kind of keep reading? And so we were getting toward the end of the school year, and I took that Bible home with me for the summer. And I remember like reading it at night under my covers with a flashlight in secret. And I began to read in all earnestness what Jesus said it meant to follow him. And I was shocked because I thought, is this what Christians believe? Is this how Christians live? When things like whoever does not hate father, mother, sister, brother for my sake is not worthy to be my disciple. So I read a lot of things that were really resonating with me. And it, for me at that point, it was like, I'm searching after truth. I never thought I was converting. I never thought I was doing anything that was contrary to my Jewish faith. So I think Sarah came and visited me one time in the summer. And I went back to school in the fall. And a lot of different things happened. But I remember saying to Sarah, if Jesus was a Jew, why aren't there other Jews who believe in him? And she's like, oh, but there are. I know somebody. She goes, I know a girl. Do you want to meet her? And I'm like, no. I don't. Get some water here. So Sarah's trying to set me up with that, a meeting with a girl, a young woman named Abby that she knew. And so it was the beginning of the school year, and I was going to services for the High Holy Days for Yom Kippur on campus at the Michigan Union. And there were tons of other Jewish kids there, and I was coming out of the Michigan Union, and I, you know, bumped into this girl, and we began to walk through campus together, and we got to the point where we were going to part ways. By the law quad, I think, and she's like, hey, can I just tell you something? She's like, I want to introduce myself. My name is Abby, and I'm from Connecticut, and my grandfather's a rabbi, and when I was 17, I fell in love with this guy named Jesus, and I believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and thought you might want to know that. Okay. Yeah, so Abby was my first Messianic Jewish friend, and we became good friends, and it was another point where God was trying to reach me and touch my heart. I went home, I continued to read the Bible, and every night, I was living back in Bursley at that point, and Sarah was not in the dorms at that point, but every night I would pray that same prayer that I had prayed and continue to read the scriptures, and now I was reading the Old Testament in light of the New. I was reading Isaiah, and I was reading the messianic prophecies. And so I went home for Thanksgiving. I got home a half a day before my sister got home, and I went out with my parents right the night before Thanksgiving, or two nights before Thanksgiving. We were at a Chinese restaurant. I don't know, Jews do that. They go out for Chinese food before Thanksgiving. And I remember talking to my parents and just saying, hey, I've been reading a lot of the scriptures, and, you know, for them that meant the Old Testament, and did you ever think Jesus could be the Messiah? And I look over my mom, who's, like, choking on her egg roll, and they're, like, clearly alarmed, and they're like, we need to go right now. We need to go home right now. So we go back to the house, and my dad gets on the phone and he calls some business associates, a couple, and who were Catholic, and he said, our daughter's like in trouble. You need to come over right away and talk to her. So they come over and they're like, what are you doing to me? You don't need to convert. You don't need to be thinking about Jesus. You're Jewish and you need to stay Jewish and just, you're going to cause a lot of trouble in your family and just take it from us. You don't need to think about Jesus. So anyway, I call that weekend kind of my sneak preview because I think looking back on it, God allowed me to experience a little bit, not a little bit, some of the costs of what this was going to be like. My mom cried all weekend and stopped talking to me. And my father they were just clearly upset. And as I was getting ready to go back to school that Sunday, my dad grabbed me and he just said, promise me one thing. He said, I will never ask you anything in your life again. That's called Jewish guilt, by the way. But he said, promise me you won't convert. And it's not like I was running back to convert or anything, but for me, I was seeking truth. And I said, Dad, I can't make that kind of promise to you, but I promise that you'll be okay, that I'll be okay. And I mean, what could he do? He couldn't lock me up. So went back to school and continued to pray that prayer. And just a few days after I got back from Thanksgiving break, I had a dream. And probably one of the most vivid dreams I have ever had. But in this dream, I was standing in this long, dark hallway, and I heard a voice call out to me, who do you say that I am? And I couldn't see anyone. And I said, I don't know who you are. And then a second time, who do you say that I am? And as I looked down this long hallway, I just saw the shape or an outline of a person. And I said, I don't know who you are, but I want to know. And then a third time, who do you say that I am? And standing in front of me, as I looked down this hallway, was Jesus. And I remember just saying, you're Jesus. And then I woke up from the dream. It was just so vivid. And I think right away that morning, I was going to the gym to work out. I think I was meeting Sarah there. And I remember telling Sarah, I had this dream. And I explained it to her. It was so vivid. And I'm like, do you think there's anything to it? And she's like... and I remember saying it, expressing, it's too hard. Like, I historically, I've done my homework. I believe he lived in history. I believe, you know, in what he taught, like from an intellectual point of view, but I don't have the faith to make this my whole life. Like, I'm going to have to, I maybe have to give up everything if I say yes to this man. I don't have the faith. I think Sarah said something to me like, which I thought at the time was very wise, but and she got it right from the Bible, which is good. She just said, basically, keep seeking, keep asking, keep knocking. Kind of don't give up. And so I continued to pray that prayer, and just a few nights later, after that dream, I was in my dorm room in Bursley, sitting on my bed. We had a loft, and my roommate was sleeping, and it was dark. And I just... you know, prayed that prayer really from the bottom of my heart, almost in desperation. It had been, I think, almost 9 months that I had been praying that prayer and just said, God, I don't know who you are, but if you're real, show me. And if Jesus is the Messiah, give me the faith to believe. And that night, I think, at, you know, Bursley Hall and the University of Michigan, something really extraordinary happened, and that was the Lord really came to me in a very profound way. I had this sense of the whole room just filling with this light and presence, and I just knew that God was with me. I didn't know who he was, and I thought, maybe I'm going to die or something. I don't know what's going on here. And I remember just in a very simple way just saying to God, I know, I believe you're here. And I'm sorry for all the ways that I've messed up my life. You know, all the commandments that I've broken or bent. Those would be the Jewish commandments, and there's a lot of them. And I just said to him very, very humbly, if you give me another chance, I want to know you, and I want to live for you. And as I prayed that prayer, I experienced that night Jesus really, the same Jesus I had seen in the dream, Jesus being there in the room with me. And I saw him holding his hand out to me like this and offering me something, and I couldn't, there was nothing that I could see. And I remember him speaking to me, not like an audible voice, but like speaking to my heart and saying, this is for you. You prayed for it and you asked for it and you sought after it. This is faith. And faith is a gift. And when the Lord held his hand out to me and offered me faith, in all those years of never knowing who he was and all those months of not knowing him at all, I just, in one split second, I just knew it was true. I don't know how to explain it, except somebody out there, please nod your head because you've experienced the same thing, right? You just know that you know that you know. And it, I knew it was a gift, and I knew that he loved me. I knew he had a plan for my life. I knew that he was walking with me, even though I felt like I was walking headlong into a lot of pain and with my family. And but I also knew it was a choice. I knew that he was offering me something that I had the ability to say no to. And so, you know, I don't know, what do you do when Jesus shows up in your dorm room? Well, if you're smart, you like, you know, say yes. And so clearly the thing I had been seeking and praying for all those months, the Lord gave to me. And I think, you know, Scripture says Jews demand signs. And I think the Lord had to kind of work in a very profound way to get my attention. So that night in my dorm room, I said, yes, Lord, I want it. I want to know you. And I knew nothing. I don't even know if I'd gotten to Revelation yet, honestly. I mean, I knew very little. But what I did know was that I met the person of Jesus. I met love. And that I wanted to spend my life, the whole rest of my life, figuring out who that person was and walking with him. And so that night, I said yes to him and began that journey of faith, which had a lot of ups and downs and a lot of pain with my family. My family ended up staying in Ann Arbor for the summer and to grow more in my faith. I found out later they hired a private investigator. I would have done the same thing. It was my kid who followed me around and went home one time. There was a pretty thick file on me, and they thought I was in a cult. They thought I was brainwashed and all of that kind of stuff. So it was there were some really difficult times where the words of these scriptures really were, I felt like I was living them out in many ways, but also times of great grace and great joy and walking with the Lord and knowing that I was choosing the right thing. Sarah eventually, you know, joined the Servants of God's Love and made her final vows and gifted me with this Bible. Because she said, I can't have more than one, and I feel like you're supposed to have this one. And she said, whenever you go and you share your story, take it with you. And I do feel so much like I take you with me when I do that. And I mean, there's obviously more to the story. I'm going to stop so people can ask questions. I eventually came into the Catholic Church, and you know, which is kind of part B of the story. So, anyway, thanks be to God. So, can you turn it off?
I never heard that story.
What?
Just kidding. Wow, such a good story.
Thanks.
You know what, and honestly, I take no credit. I was just, you know, God put me in Bursley. I didn't want to be in Bursley. What the heck is Bursley, you know? It's, you know, in the outback. But, you know, I never met a Jew before. She never met a non-Jew. I never met a Jew, and I'm like, a Jew? A chosen one, right? You didn't know how chosen you were. And but, you know, it really was about befriending you. You know, it really was, you know, like relationship. Yeah, I really didn't know exactly what I loved the Lord. And, you know, my way of trying to be a good witness, I don't know if you remember, Deb, when we had that championship basketball team game, and we borrowed somebody's car. Okay, I borrowed somebody's car, and I parked it illegally. And, well, we won the game.
We did.
We were pimps. And we came out to get in the borrowed car, and we walked through the parking space. And we had a philosophy exam the next day, and I remember just kicking myself and saying, well, oh. And all the way, I can still remember this, all the way up State Street, I'm thinking to myself, I need to be a good person. But everything in me was like, I'm sick of it here.
Anyway. No profanity.
Yes, there was no profanity.
Yeah.
But you know what? Some of you, think about this. But first of all, does anyone have any questions? Yeah, but we had to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know?
It was towed.
I mean, the sign that said no parking was kind of upside down and hanging in a tree. We're just stupid. We're like, it's just an apartment complex. Who cares? But I realized you don't park where you're not supposed to. But, yeah, there's questions. Sister Kelly.
Yeah, I think some things started to thaw out. There were some rocky years because I was kind of like, man, I already gave up everything. I'm going for it. Like, you know, I was with the sisters for a while, really pursuing the single life and consecrated life, and you know, there's just I was very zealous, and I probably would have done some things differently. Probably some of the things I did maybe alienated them or made it hard for them to understand what I was doing, but they didn't want to have anything to do with my life in Ann Arbor, and so I wasn't allowed to talk about what I believed, even after Peter and I were married, but I think they began to thaw a bit. It was very hard for them when I married Peter because he wasn't Jewish, and he, you know, kind of looked like Jesus back then, and he was a full-time Catholic, you know, missionary. So, I mean, at least he could have been a doctor or something, or a lawyer. But so we had what we call the don't ask, don't tell policy, and that was like you just, we're not allowed to talk about it. So it was really difficult going home. But once the grandkids started to come, that thawed things quite a bit. And then, you know, there's some things, I mean, we didn't raise our kids perfectly by any means, but there's nothing that speaks more loudly than just happy, well-adjusted kids. And I think for the most part, our kids were the main conduits of God's love for my parents. And then my mom was on her 70th birthday. She was diagnosed with cancer and given 6 weeks to live, and died 6 weeks to the day. And I would say the last 6 weeks of her life, there was tremendous healing, personal healing that happened between us and even in her own heart. And when my sister and brother and I gathered around her bedside as she was dying, both my siblings looked at me and said, Debbie, would you pray? And so I was able to pray in Hebrew, you know, pray Psalm 23 and just pray for my mom and kind of pray in her ear, really, you know, offering her, you know, the Lord's mercy. And so I think there was a lot of healing there. And then my dad died 3 years after my mom died, rather suddenly too, and kind of a similar thing there. So trusting in God's mercy for them, and I think there was a lot of healing that happened. And then probably the last one was my grandmother, who was the matriarch, Jewish matriarch. Dorsey, you met my grandma. Yes. And beautiful woman.
Yeah.
She died at 102 2 years ago. And I prayed for her so much. She called me Debbie Darling. She was just like this tremendous woman. But she, I prayed for her that somehow God would intervene in her life. She had faith in God, but didn't know Jesus. And 3 years before she died, a woman came to, she was living in an assisted living, very nice place in Chicago, and a woman began to work there, was a nurse. And this woman was like so serious about her Catholic faith. I mean, she watched Peter on EWTN. She was just like so into it, you know. And she began to pray the rosary with my grandmother. Yeah, and so when I went to be with my grandmother on her deathbed, she turned to me, and she said, just hours before she died, she said, Debbie, darling, I feel like Jesus on the cross right now. Whoa. So I don't know what was going on in her heart and in her soul and in her mind, but something was happening there that the Lord was working. So sometimes it's better not to say too much and just let your life be a witness and let God give opportunities. So, yeah, so I'm claiming them, you know, for the Lord even now, you know. So we'll see. He came, he moved to Michigan. He went to the seminary and left the seminary, discerned out of the seminary, and then came to live in Ann Arbor, be part of the community here, and we began to work on campus together, doing University Christian Outreach work. We were both on staff, and we met there, and yeah, the rest is history, as they say. So.
And how did you end up Catholic?
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you like the one-minute version, which is basically Peter and I started to date, and well, he said, "I'm Catholic and I want to marry a Catholic," and I said, "I really like you, but I don't want to become Catholic to marry you." I mean, it was kind of I said probably nicer than that, but this is not a convenience thing. If I'm going to be Catholic, I want to have conviction, and I thought, I'm Jewish, why do I need to be Catholic? Because I didn't really know anything about the church. So we made an agreement that I would pursue the Catholic faith without his help, which was very difficult for him. And I began to meet with a Catholic priest who was kind of a mutual friend named Father Frank McGrath. And we'd just go over all the different kind of issues that non-Catholics talk about. And so we began to kind of tackle those one by one, just meeting privately. And then one day I was praying, and the Lord said to me, I want to introduce you to Mary. And I said, Mary who? And I went to meet with Father Frank, and he said, I was praying for you this morning, and the Lord told me he wants you to meet his mother. So I began to just open up the scriptures and began to look for Mary in the scriptures and read about her. And I came across the passage where Mary goes to be with Elizabeth in her time of need. And I felt like Mary was saying to me, I'm here for you in your time of need. My mother was not in my life at that point, and I was about to embark on some pretty major life decisions. And so I just began to experience Mary really in a very personal, motherly way, walking alongside of me. Besides the fact that I'm like, wow, she's Jewish too, and, you know, and she's young, and like, I don't know, they're just a lot of connections. So I started going to Mass to observe, and I was like, wow, look at all this stuff here. They got that from us, and they got that from us, and yeah. So there are a lot of connections, and then I began to read more and you know, read about, you know, the Eucharist and Passover, and it was just like connecting all the dots and all the lights going on. And so I ended up coming into the church on Palm Sunday, and we were married a couple weeks after that by a rabbi and a priest. Under a chuppah. Most tense wedding in the history of weddings. So we actually did not videotape it because we never wanted to relive it again. So it was really, really tense. But the bar opened and then everybody was pretty happy. You know? Yeah.
The dancing started.
Yeah, the dancing started. Mara.
We'll take one more.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with your sister?
It's been up and down. Yeah, it's a whole... If you want to go for a drink sometime, I'll take you kind of. but we're so bonded. We're identical twins, and so there's so much that we share, you know, even without words, that is really good. And she's kind of on her own journey that's had a lot of difficulties, but we're very close. And she's calling me now and asking for prayer. She's going through a difficult time in her life, and so I'm her go-to. And so I think there's a lot of, and, you know, my brother's very involved with his faith and president of the synagogue and all that. So praying, you know. All right. Well, thanks, ladies. Thanks for...